Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, it's time for the Negative Positives Podcast, coming to you live out of the Gutter Man Cave in beautiful Louisville, Kentucky. And now, here are your hosts, Andre Dominguez and Mike Gutterman.
Hello, and welcome to the Negative Positives Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Gutterman, coming to you from the Gutterman Cave on a Monday night. This is episode 145, and it's a Monday night. We're recording Monday night, but this will be for the midweek episode that will probably appear on your favorite podcast catchers on Thursday morning. But it's always a joy to do these now with Andre's new schedule, where he can join us for the midweek episode. And since I just said that, obviously Andre is on the line with us, everyone's favorite co-captain, Mr. Andre Dominguez. How are you doing tonight, Andre?
I'm doing very well, Mike. We had a lovely, you know, day and evening at Cinestill, ending up at one of our favorite local Hollywood bars, the Blue Palms Brew House, for some build-your-own burgers on Monday and happy hour. So took me a little while longer to get home to get ready to record with you, but I'm in a great mood.
Yeah, I'm in a great mood as myself. I'm kind of living up to the Monday night recording because I'm a little drunk, just to be honest. And because I met up with one of my former bandmates from one of my former bands, and there's talk of one of my bands getting back together for a reunion show. My band Sea Hero, which is one of my favorite music projects I've ever been involved with. There's a good chance we might be trying to do like a one-off reunion show. So there's been some talk about that. Got me very excited. And that meant that we did some shots of bourbon to celebrate. And so I'm kind of back to my old ways of Monday night drunken podcasts. So.
And Mike, what was this lovely bourbon that y'all were taking celebratory shots of?
Well, I took Dustin Cogsdale's advice. Last night I was drinking kind of the basic Evan Williams bourbon. He told me to try the single barrel bourbon from Evan Williams. So we took a shot of that. It was delicious. It kind of finished with a little note of a little butterscotch flavor. So it was quite tasty. So it's definitely on my next purchase list for bourbons. And it was delicious, very smooth. Nice finish, nice little sort of strange butterscotch finish. So it was exciting. I liked it.
Well, we just had Dustin on last night. For you guys, it'll have been a few days since you heard his lovely voice and opinions and conversation on this podcast. But I'm sure he'll be glad to hear that you enjoyed the Evan Williams single barrel. I actually was mainly sipping on today another one of Dustin's favorites, the Four Roses single barrels. So we both had some you know, good celebratory evenings with some of Dustin's favorite bourbons, so can't complain all around.
Right, good choices. Like, see, I think all we're trying to get out of guests on this show is like you know, bourbon suggestions. So like, we don't really care about your photography, we just want to know what good bourbons are. So we didn't get to cover some things on the Sunday night podcast because, well, we ran a little long, and then Andre decided to lock himself out of his bedroom, and so we needed to kind of, you know, cover some subjects that we didn't get to on the Sunday night episode. Andre hasn't had a whole lot happen since we recorded last night, But I did want to talk about my art show that I've talked about quite a bit in the last month or two. And that was on Saturday. And I got a lot of strange observations about it. Like, overall, it was a success. It was the first time this art show has ever, like, it was the inaugural show, I guess. First year they've ever done this. And it was kind of deemed enough a success where the organizers of the event has decided that they want to do it again next year, which I would gladly participate in. It was kind of a light crowd, people kind of coming through the booths kind of sporadically. But overall, from 4 p.m. to 11 p.m., I managed to sell like 15 photos. And basically, it covered the cost of the materials that I had to buy, because this is the first art show that I had to buy like a 10 by 10 canopy, had to buy like pegboard to hang the photos on, and a folding table. So like, it covered my cost of materials and then gave me a little extra money beyond that. So next time I do a show like this, I will already have those materials paid for. So everything will be, I guess, somewhat profit, you know, from here on out. But it was the first time I've had to like set up a canopy or a tent, that kind of booth. And but sold 15 photos, can't complain, like in that kind of time span, and a first time of an art show. So overall a success, and I would be glad to do it again. But strangely, I have some observations about it, and I've talked a lot about these outdoor art shows. First of all, with this art show, we are in a pretty low income area of town, and I'm not trying to sound stereotypical or mean, but this in Louisville would be considered a redneck area of town.
So, all right, man, if it's self-deprecating humor, it's fine.
Well, I mean, I can't really like call this area town out too much because it's considered south end of Louisville, and I've lived my entire life in the south end, and south end has kind of been a little redneck from my entire life. I didn't grow up, and where I live now is not quite as south end as where this was, because this was like deep woods south end. And let's be honest, I'm not trying to like pigeonhole people or be stereotypical, but this is not exactly considered an artistic side of town. Like, these are working folks. Like, they are living paycheck to paycheck. It's a low income kind of area. Like, to get them to buy something that is non-essential as art is a tough decision for them. So I was a little worried going into it, and but did well. And my philosophy of going, my strategy of going into this art show was to sell as cheap as possible, buy the cheapest frames as possible, make the cheapest mats as possible, and keep my price as low as possible, because we're going into a low income area of town. And I think that paid off. I walked around before the show, I got set up, and then I walked around to the other booths of the other artists before the show, and it kind of started. And there was people there with like paintings, I don't know, probably 1 or 2 foot wide, I don't know, like, I really can't explain, but like, not huge paintings. And some of them were trying to sell these paintings for $7,500, and they didn't sell anything. And I could have told them right from the get go, dude, you're not gonna sell these. This is not your crowd. Like, this, the crowd that's gonna come to this is not gonna drop $100 on a piece of art. And I don't understand why artists have such a hard time with understanding their market. And I get it. Like, you put a lot of time into this. And look, even my photos, like, I didn't get paid for all my time and everything that went into, like, selling these photos. But you got to realize your market, and it's just a... I get it. Like, you took a lot of hours. This is a one of a kind painting, and it probably deserves $75 or $100, but you're not going to sell that in a low income area at an outside art show with two porta pots next to your booth. It's just a different thing. And I don't understand why artists don't realize that. And maybe when you're going to an event like that, maybe not try to sell those big paintings. Maybe make really small paintings, and where you can lower your price down to the income level that you're selling to. But it just, I see it time and time again, and I get it. Like, as artists, we all deserve more money than we get. But it just, you got to know your audience. And I don't know, Andre, am I making sense now?
No, you're making complete sense. Like, I have a couple of things that I want to say about that. You know, one that I think that all art schools and conservatories and, you know, major programs at community colleges and stuff like that, if you're doing something art related, you should be required to take a few business classes, like an accounting class and entrepreneurship class, a very like basic sort of intro to marketing class. Because it's not enough just to produce this artwork. You need to have like a semi-solid like head on your shoulders when it comes to actually like, you know, understanding your market and pricing things to a level that people are going to be able to afford it. And yeah, I mean, I think you've talked about your the way that you go about, you know, kind of choosing what frames, and it's actually been pretty fun because we've been following kind of your journey preparing for this art show for a while. So we've seen, you know, the decisions that you've been making along the road of, you know, finding a bunch of those cheap frames at Walmart and you know, cutting the mats, and you've showed us how to do that. And you've acknowledged, like, throughout the whole process that, like, you know, are these going to be the best mats in the world? No, but given the specific, you know, this specific show, you know, I'm trying to keep my costs down as much as possible. Therefore, I'm going to be using this cardstock over some different material. So, you know, I think you did a good job. I want to congratulate you on selling 15 prints. Your whole setup with the canopy and the pegboard, I thought looked super cool from the video that you posted. And hey, I'm glad that they invited you back. I think that you know, you the pictures that I've seen that you sell at these art shows are not only really good, but, you know, very kind of classic Louisville stuff, which I think also, you know, helps because you very much sort of tap into, you know, what would people you know, want to sort of put on their walls. Not something super like, you know, esoteric and kind of out there, but like, you know, something that reminds them of their city, something that reminds them of Louisville. So congrats, buddy. I'm always super inspired when you talk about and you participate in these art shows, because it's something that I've never done, and I don't know if I ever will. I might just live vicariously through you.
Well, I mean, it's funny because, like, and generally in any art show, I do try to throw some weird stuff up, some like non-Louisville stuff up, and I'm always super excited when that stuff sells. And I did sell a couple of those type photos, but it is, it's kind of the way it is, man. Like, people love local photos, things they can identify with. And so the way I try to approach that is to not take the stereotypical shot of those kind of Louisville landmarks or whatever. And then secondly, it's like, you know, I get it. I kind of approach this from a I'm not like a full-time artist, and like sometimes I go to these art shows and some of these people are like full-time artists. This is how they make their living. They go to art show to art show to art show, and that's why they need to try to get as much money as they possibly can off every sale. Now granted, I have a job that pays my bills. I kind of approach my photography as far as selling just to support the hobby. Now granted, if I can support the hobby and make a little above and beyond that, to maybe take the family out for a nice dinner after it, that's a bonus. But so maybe I'm coming to it from not quite as a desperate situation as like somebody that's a full-time artist, that this is how they make their living. But you know, it's all about your goals and where you're at with it. And I feel like honestly, I've been doing this for 14 years in art fairs, and I've just figured out my process. And I'm telling anybody that wants to try to do it, it's going to take a couple years to figure it out. And once you do, you're going to figure out how much I'm comfortable at like selling these things for, what actually sells, and how much I expect as far as profit out of these type situations, and what will make me happy. And once you get that figured out, the formula becomes pretty easy. So I just recommend like go into these things and kind of expect to have a couple year learning curve. This is the first time I've done this show in this area of town. I was more successful than I expected. I went in with the lowest of expectations and did better than I thought. My strategy of selling really cheap worked out, and the good thing was I was able to like pay for the materials that it cost me to like do this art show, come out a little ahead beyond that. And so next time I do an art show like this, I already have the canopy, the pegboard, and all that stuff. So next time I do a show like this, it'll all be kind of more in the profit category. But yeah, it's just it's an interesting thing. I think we all take photos and we want people to see them, but I think at some point everyone that's really into this needs to try to get out there and see if someone is willing to buy their photography, like buy a piece from you. It's nice to get likes or comments or compliments on social media, but when somebody opens their wallet and pays you for a framed photo and you know that's going to go hang in their house, that's an extremely rewarding thing. That it's very humbling, and it's just a really awesome feeling. So I definitely encourage all the fine listeners here, which I mean, so many of you guys are doing such amazing work. Get out there, do an art show. Look, have low expectations. Don't expect much, and then learn the process. And when you sell something, it's the best feeling in the world.
See, now I like yes to all of that. But is it bad if I like, and it's also kind of ironic that like me, the business major, is just like, I probably won't ever sell anything. If anything, I, you know, will probably end up pulling an Andrew Bartram and just, you know, set aside some money and like budget out money for making prints that I can just like send to friends.
No, that's perfectly relevant. And like, I think that that's something that I want to do as well. Like, I'm all about, like, I love this idea of like sending prints to people that just want one and just giving it away. But there is something, the thing about an art show or participating in an art show is it's the scariest, and it may be one of the scariest things you'll do as a photographer, because like you are putting your stuff out there for the public to scrutinize and vote with their wallets. And it's, it can be very intimidating, but once you do it a little bit and get your process down, you kind of get some confidence. And I think that confidence helps throughout your entire photography. Once you start like selling photos, when somebody's opening up their wallet to buy your work, it is, hey man, I'm a pretty damn good photographer. People are paying me for it. Like, and I like that confidence, because you know, we all like second guess our, our art or whatever. And it's just it's a nice validation when someone's willing to, not just double click and give you a like or make a comment on social media. It's a real huge validation that you're kind of doing something right when they're willing to open up their wallet and, buy a photo from you. So I think it's something that I do think everyone should try it. Like it may not be for you, but I think everyone should try it at least once. And Andre, I'm going to challenge you to do it at least once in your life. So yeah.
we'll see. And I love that like Mike is giving all this like, you know, this inspirational advice, and he's being the, for once, the mature one here. Meanwhile, I'm just sitting here kind of thinking like, you know how the majority of people that work for these companies in the film photography industry, like the folks that work at Kodak and Ilford and blah, 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 like, you know, I love the fact that, you know, they work in the film photography industry, but nobody's really like, you know, critiquing their work or, you know, saying like, oh, you're not that good of a photographer. That's my goal, is to work in the film photography industry and, you know, take my own pictures and just like pop them on, you know, the Facebook group and Instagram, but not really have to worry about like, you know, real people making actual judgments about my photography and deciding whether or not they want to, whether they think it's worth their hard-earned dollars. But I promise to you, Mike, that at some point I will, you know, do something similar.
Yeah, you should, man. It's rewarding, man. Like, it really is. Like, I almost first year I tried to sell photos, like, I almost gave up on it. Like, oh, this sucks. Like, I must be a horrible photographer. And I hate myself about this. Like, why did I come out here? This is embarrassing. But now it's like, I look forward to these events. And like, I went into this one with low expectations, came out above my expectations. But had I not sold anything, it wouldn't have surprised me. And honestly, it wouldn't have discouraged me, because you just never know. Like, you get into these situations and you just see what happens. You hope for the best and expect the worst. And, you know, and it's not that, and if you go out to one of these type shows and you don't sell a single damn photo, doesn't mean you're not a good photographer. It just means the right person didn't walk up, you know? So that's the way you got to look at it. But
it's tough, because I also think like one of my favorite images is that, that portrait of my friend that I shot in a coffee shop, with the, you know, she's like sipping her coffee with my M3 in front of her. If I ever like were to like try to sell a photo, I probably like would want to start with that one. Mm-hmm. But like, we never did like a model release or anything, and I need to like talk to her to see if she'd be okay with me potentially making money on that. I don't know. See, these are things like I don't like having to think about this stuff. it's already stressing me out.
She'd be fine with it. Like, a model release is nothing. It's not like you're gonna make. It's not like you're gonna like, you know, buy a Bruce Willis's mansion in Hollywood off of what you make off that print. You know, so I think
she'd be fine. If somebody gave me like $5 for it. Anywho, yeah. Mike, what do you say we take a quick break and talk about some new camera news.
Absolutely. Let's do that. All right, folks, we shall be right back after we take a little break. Folks, we are back, and there's been some big news in the last week, and we meant to talk about it on the Sunday episode, but again, Andre locked himself out of his bedroom when he had to go take a poop, I guess. But so.
A, I like to clarify the fact that I was not pooping. And B, you're really going to milk this, aren't you, Mike?
So, well, you know, it is what it is. But, you know, hey, look, it's nature. You know, everybody's got to do it. And if you act like you don't have to do it, then you're full of S-H-I-T. But, so the big news this week was the Diana Instant Square. And when they first put out, like, the teasers online about it, they talked embrace imperfection and all this stuff. And personally, I kind of thought and was kind of excited about it because I thought, imperfection? Are they finally going to make a Lomo camera for Polaroid? And I don't mean that as a slight against Polaroid, but Polaroid film is a little more imperfect than a Fuji Instax film. But turns out, no, it's still the Instant Square format, but they threw it in a Diana camera with the, like, the vignetting that Dianas do with, like, there's a bunch of lens attachments you can get for it. It's interesting, and they're selling it. I think the Kickstarter, I guess, is like, it's like $99. So it's not crazy expensive. I could see where a lot of people would be excited about it. And again, I will never really talk a lot of crap about Lomography because I felt like overall they've been a huge positive to the film community. It's, but I will say this, it's not for me, and I'm not going to buy it, but I know many people will, and I'm sure it'll be a hugely successful campaign for them, and they'll probably sell a ton of them. You know, it's still positive news. It's a new film camera, and I think that that's always a positive. So, Andre, what do you think about this Diana Instant Square?
I think it is, you know, very interesting when you think about it, that Lomo hasn't embraced the fact that the Polaroid Originals film, you know, has its imperfections and its inconsistencies and its sort of surprise, this either came out really good or really bad, characteristic, because that seems much more, you know, along the lines of Lomo's brand, at least with, like, the, I don't know, the number of, like, quote-unquote rules of Lomography that they, you know, tout. With Instax being, you know, a very kind of consistently performing emulsion. Granted, like, you know, the actual meters in the cameras will dictate what your camera's actually doing to expose that film. And that's where you get some variability in the results. But the actual emulsion is a Fuji commodity at this point. They've been doing it since the late 90s, early 2000s. But another thing that I do want to kind of think about with this camera is that for $99, that's if I'm not mistaken, that's the price that the One Step 2 was when it first came out. And I actually just recently got a newsletter from Freestyle Photographics here in sunny Hollywood, California, that Polaroid released the One Step 2 with an extended viewfinder.
I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you see that? I got that email. I've really seen much marketing of it from Polaroid itself, but I did get that newsletter, and I thought it was interesting because, you know, not only does it make it easier for us glasses users to use it, apparently they made some changes to the viewfinder to make the parallax error, you know, essentially less so. They made it so that what you're seeing in the viewfinder at the distances that most people are shooting their One Step 2s, like, you know, portraits that kind of waist up of their friends and things, you know, 2, 3, 4 meters away from them, that what you saw in the viewfinder would be closer to what you actually got in the print. Because I know that a lot of people complained that, you know, the parallax error was like really, really significant at closer ranges.
Yeah, the original one step two. I mean, if you look at where the viewfinder is compared to where the lens is, it's way, the viewfinder's way over to the side. So if they corrected that a little bit, that'd be awesome. I think the one the Freestyle is selling with the longer kind of viewfinder and a little bit more corrected, I think it's like 119, I believe, rather than the ones the one step two is like the original one is like 99. I think it's like $20 more to get that option, and which I would probably spring for if I was buying one now. But I already have a one step two, so I'm not going to buy another one. But it's a good idea. But yeah, you're right. Polaroid's been kind of quiet about it from their standpoint, but Freestyle definitely sent out an email notification about it. But as far as the Diana Instant Square, the thing I wonder about that is, once people get it, how many people are going to be disappointed with it? Because I don't think it has any sort of electronic exposure, like a meter on it. I think it's just kind of guesswork with apertures, right? Like, if I don't think there's any sort of like electronic exposure on that. Am I right?
I'm going to be completely honest. I have not really looked into this camera because as soon as I heard about it, I knew it wasn't for me. Professional researching before recording the podcast, folks.
Well, I mean, I did look into it a little bit, and I don't recall seeing anything about like it having any sort of electronic control over like exposure. I believe it's just a matter of it doesn't give you like shutter speed options. It gives you aperture options, I believe. So you're going to kind of have to know what you're doing to get good results out of that. So if I'm remembering reading this correctly, again, I like Andre, I haven't looked into it too much because once I saw it, I was like, that's cool, but I'm not necessarily, I knew it wasn't for me, but yeah, like Andre said, I am surprised that Lomography and Polaroid hasn't teamed up at some point, because they both seem to have a large section of the same audience, the same sort of like people that would be into Polaroid would be into Lomography. Like, the fact that those two companies haven't hooked up is kind of surprising. I guess maybe they just have a good relationship with Fuji at this point, and maybe that's why. Or I mean, who knows, folks? There might be some strange rift between Polaroid and Lomography that we don't know behind the scenes, but I don't know.
Another thing that kind of, I mean, not necessarily on that topic, but it is a good thing for Polaroid, for, you know, new cameras that shoot Instax Square being released. I mean, you've got now two cameras out of Lomography that shoot it. There's you know, Camera Film Photo out in Hong Kong that's doing that like Frankenstax thing with the Fuji Instax SQ6, kind of grafted onto the back of an RB67, mm-hmm. So that you can use it kind of as an instant back, because what that does is that it puts pressure on Polaroid originals to have to compete with them to make their film the best it can be, because, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that can shoot Instax Square, so Polaroid's got to step up to the plate and you know, not lose too much market share, which is, it's a good, as a consumer, we're the ones who win from that rigorous competition between the two.
For sure, yeah, because I mean, if Polaroid was the only game in town, we might still be having to deal with the early Impossible project formulations that like faded like 3 days after you took it, but so yeah, competition is good, and but I've got too many good Polaroid cameras, so I'm sticking with Polaroid for my instant photography. So I would say like instant photography is about maybe less than 5% of my photography, and I just don't see me getting into Instax at this point, because I am able to fulfill that 5% with my Polaroid cameras and Polaroid Originals film, and I just don't see me like dividing that up and buying into the Instax system and then having to split that like 2.5% between the two. Yeah, you know, but yeah, I mean, if you're into Instax, I think it's a good thing. I haven't heard any more about this lawsuit between Polaroid and Fuji. I wonder what happened to that, because I know Polaroid was trying to sue Fuji when they came out with their square format, because Polaroid was claiming that it was too close to their kind of square, like iconic Polaroid print sort of look. I haven't heard any more about that, so maybe, I don't know if it got dropped, or maybe it's just one of those legal things that takes forever to work out. But it was kind of hot news about 4 or 5 months ago, and I haven't heard any more about that. So
yeah, neither have I. And like, business major I may be, and you know, proponent of intellectual property rights I may be, as a consumer, I kind of want Fuji to keep, you know, making Instax Square so that it gives Polaroid Originals the fire under its butt that it needs to make the film better.
Yeah, I totally agree. But
yeah, that thing of you know, of having instant cameras that shoot both Instax and Polaroid is something that, you know, you've mentioned a few times, Mike. I've never really put too much thought into it. It does happen to be the case that all my instant cameras do shoot Polaroid film and not Instax, but and that's less so like an, oh, I don't want to support Fuji thing, but you're right. The fact that I can, you know, shoot 600 series Polaroid film in my 600 series camera in my SX70 with an ND filter on is really great, because I can basically just buy one type of film and use it with all my cameras.
Yeah. And one thing I really like about, and honestly, I mean, I have an SX70. It's an awesome camera, and I would prefer to shoot all my instant photography out of it, but I have to buy like the actual packs with the battery in it, which I think they're selling for, what is it, like
$18?
Yeah. But the main reason I bought the Polaroid, One Step 2, is because it has its own internal battery, and I'm able to buy the iType film, which doesn't have the battery inside the film pack, and I get it for like $15. So it ends up being about like $2 a shot. Even though I don't like that camera as much, I do like the fact that I save some money on the film, and it's not quite so pricey. But yeah, but it's a, but you know, it's, I don't know. I don't expect perfection out of instant photography. I actually embrace imperfection in it. So I think that's why I resonate with Polaroid, and I can like deal with the issues with it. Like, if I want perfection, I'm gonna grab my Pentax 6.7 or 6.45 and throw some really awesome film in there and get like really nice, sharp, perfect photos. But like, when I go out with an instant camera, I'm looking for lo-fi. And maybe that's what you have to decide when you're shooting instant photography. Are you looking for lo-fi, or do you expect perfection? And if you're a perfection guy, maybe this instant or Instax is maybe for you. But for me, instant photography to me is about imperfection, and or at least a different look. And so that's where I'm kind of always been a Polaroid guy. Yeah.
Definitely.
All right. Well, I think we've covered the Diana Instant Square. Andre and I have pretty much decided it isn't for us, but if it's for you, by all means, back it. And I'm sure they don't need our ringing endorsement, because anything Lamography puts out on Kickstarter usually blows up. So I'm sure they're going to do fine with it. But, and I wish them the best of luck for it, because, like I said, I don't hate on mammography. I see them as a huge positive in the film community. So good on them. And I wish them the best of luck. Right? Right, Andre?
Yeah. No, I thought that went without saying.
Nice. Okay. Well, let's take a break here. And we have a call in to address and another little thing we want to talk about. So we'll take a break and we'll be right back, folks. All right, folks, we are back from our break, and we had a call into the show from Mr. Graham Young. Now, Mr. Graham Young has a podcast called the Homemade Camera Podcast, and I've been listening to that and enjoying it quite a bit. He has also made a little webpage that helps you find all the film photography podcasts that are out there, so that you can start listening to those in case there's any out there that you maybe don't know about. So, but he did send us a little voice call in on the Anchor app about it. He did get cut off at the end because I think they give you a minute to record, and he kind of got cut off. But I think his main point was he got his main point through. So let's listen to the call in from Mr. Graham Young.
Hey, Mike and Andre, this is Graham Young. Just a little message to tell you that I really enjoyed the last podcast with John Gregory. I think you guys did a great job. And I just wanted to remind everybody, you talked a little bit about how to find new podcasts, and people who are starting new podcasts, how to get new listeners. I just want to remind you about filmpodcastnetwork.com. I set that up because I was tired of missing podcasts, finding out that podcasts had been running for 3 months and hadn't yet to hear about them. So it's a listing site for podcasts, and y'all are listed. A1 Film, Rediscovering Film is on there as well. If anybody's out there starting a podcast and wants to get some listeners, or somebody wants to find one.
Yeah, he got cut off. But yeah, that website is awesome. It's the Film Photography Podcast Network, I believe it is. And
filmpodcastnetwork.com.
Oh, Film Podcast Network, yeah. And we are listed on there, Andre. I love his description for our show. It's like something like Mike and sometimes Andre talk about.
I'll read it right here.
Nice.
Mike, in parentheses, and sometimes Andre talk about shooting film in a digital age, occasionally while drinking beer and bourbon. I think I've said it better myself.
It's a very accurate description, and but yeah, it's an awesome source to find all the film podcasts that are out there. And if you are doing a film podcast and you're not on that list, definitely get a hold of Mr. Graham Young and get on that list. It's a nice little sort of all-in-one sort of place to find out, you know, all the film podcasting that's going on. And I thank you, Graham Young, so much for reminding us that. I haven't plugged it as much as I probably should have. And but yeah, and also listen to his podcast, the Homemade Camera Podcast. And they do all sorts of crazy experiments of like basically building cameras by hand out of crazy parts. And it's very interesting, and kind of makes me want to like do more in the gutter man cave other than drink beer. Kind of want to like start building
cameras.
Put all
those tools that you have on on the pegboard and
that's right.
And that's right. At your desk to some use, Mike.
I know they're starting to collect dust. Speaking of podcasts, we did talk a couple weeks ago or a couple episodes ago about Juan Rubin, his podcast, A1 Film Photography Revisited, and we was encouraging him to keep going. But there's been some news about that situation, and I haven't quite caught up to his most recent episode, but Andre has. So Andre, can you tell us about that situation?
Yeah, so if you guys haven't listened to the most recent episode on Juan's podcast, he didn't give too much detail, but he essentially said that there was some kind of accident, and that for the foreseeable future, he's going to have to take a bit of a pause from recording the podcast. He thanked Mike and I for giving him a shout out on the Negative Positives podcast, as well as all the people who came over on Anchor or any other platforms to start listening to his rambles about cameras and film. I mean, that's how we started as well. So we know exactly how it feels to have new people, listen to the podcast and start, finally kind of caring what it is about what you have to say. But with not a whole lot of detail, whether or not Juan was in an accident or somebody that he loves and cares for was in an accident, he has to take care of them, regardless of what the actual background or the issue is, we do just want to send him our best, to let him know that if there's anything that he needs, that we're here for him. Mike and I are both going to be leaving call-ins on his podcast through Anchor, and we encourage you all to do the same. Wish Juan your best, and encourage him, whenever he is ready to get back to podcasting, that we'll be here to support him, just show him one of the many little ways why the film community is the best place to be, and why people constantly say one of the reasons why they enjoy shooting film is that sense of community. So that's just a little something that Mike and I wanted to put out there and encourage you guys. Even if you don't use Anchor, if that's not the way that you listen to your podcast, one of the things that makes Anchor so special is the call-in feature. So whereas we usually, use some opportunity within the episode to encourage people to leave us call-ins, this week, go ahead and send Juan a call-in.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it would be an awesome show of support. And if somebody's struggling in this community, if we are truly a community, we should reach out and offer encouragement and offer support. And I feel like one way we can do that right now for Juan is send him a call in and let him know we're here and we're concerned, and we want him to get back on top of the game. And whenever he's ready to podcast, we'll be ready to listen and support him. And we will certainly keep you updated if he ever gets a podcast back up and running. And even if he doesn't, he has quite a few episodes out, 13, 14 episodes, something like that. And you should listen to those anyway, because they're entertaining. And he was coming from a perspective of somebody new to film. And that was a different perspective than a lot of podcasts that are out there, as a different take. And I think it's always interesting to have a different take on the whole film podcast community. So absolutely, we encourage everyone, give Juan a little voice call in, man. Give him a little shout of encouragement. I think it'll make his day. And let's show some love. And I think it's it'd be an awesome thing for all of us to do. So yeah, so anything else on that, Andre?
No, I actually think that's the perfect note to go out on, just a positive little show of support from our wonderfully weird film photography family here at the Negative Positives, just to send a little love to somebody who
probably needs
it. Who's a member of this community and who's been so great in reaching out to us and saying that we in our own small way inspired him to start his own podcast. So whatever way we can give back to him and support him and to all of you, know that we're here for you guys.
Yeah, that's awesome. And on that positive note, let's go ahead and end this, Andre. Before we both maybe get, I don't know, pass out from too much drinking tonight. So, Andre, where can people see your 9 photos at right now?
People can see my 9 photos on Instagram at Andre on Film, as well as possibly some more than the 9 on the Negative Positives Film Photography Podcast Facebook group.
Nice. People can see my work on Instagram at Gutterman Photo, on Facebook at Mike Gutterman Photography. You can email this program at guttermanphoto@gmail.com. And obviously, join the Facebook group, the Negative Positives Film Photography Podcast Facebook group. That's the end of the show, folks, and we will see you on Sunday night with a new guest we already have lined up, which I'm excited about. And so let's end this thing, Andre. Everybody stay positive.
Shoot some cool film photos and leave Juan Rubin calling on Anchor.
Yes. All right, everyone. We'll see you very soon. Thank you very much.
Take care.